talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. Today is August 22nd. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
Lynn Venhouse is again. She's back. She's sitting in the coveted Michelle chair.
It's a two-time winner here.
That's right. 2 weeks in a row.
Well, thank you, guys.
Oh, sure, sure. And this is, of course, the Weird Movie Geeks podcast. First, we're going to call Michelle McHugh to talk about the top 12 at the box office. I've got Michelle McHugh on the phone. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, everybody. How is everyone?
Hi, good. Hello, Michelle.
Good morning, Michelle.
Back to school.
Hi, Jim.
Right. So what's going on?
See, lots of stuff going on at the box office this weekend.
Okay, such
as Suicide Squad, the Warner Brothers DC Comics anti-superhero film, easily crossed the 500 million mark worldwide with 572.7 million earned through this weekend to be the number one box office draw in America. The film brought in 20.7 here in the state. Yeah, so it's still doing incredibly well, and it's had quite a bit of a drop-off this weekend, as a matter of fact, but it's still doing really well.
Well, doesn't have any competition.
Yeah, that's true. And even with the critics bashing it, I mean, and I spoke with a lot of, especially the demographic that it was leaning towards, that 20 to, you know, maybe early 30s, they love it. Across the board, the younger people are loving it. And they're going to see it despite what the critics are saying. They're doing, they're always doing it in protest of what the critics are saying.
Oh, I see. And Ben-Hur was hot on its heels, right?
Oh, God.
Oh, what?
Did you see Variety said that is like the big flop of the summer. But we're going to get to that in a minute. At number two is Sony Pictures' Sausage Party. That film brought in $15.3 million.
Yeah, that I was surprised, Michelle, that holding on to the number two spot. I thought it would be in the top five, but it seems to be connecting with the audiences, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, the film had a drop of 55% from its debut weekend. That's really, really good, though. I mean, its domestic haul now stands at $65.3 million.
So it's easily in profit mode now, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, and word of mouth, people, you know, you talk to people who have seen it, and everybody agrees it's hilarious. But three is Warner Brothers Pictures' War Dogs. That film brought in $14.3 million. That's another one that's doing really, really well with good word of mouth. That film teams up Jonah Hill and Miles Teller, but originally was supposed to star Shia LaBeouf and Jesse Eisenberg. Ticket buyers for that film were mostly male, 56% made up the movie-going audience under the age of 35.
Okay.
At number four is Focus Features, which I'm pleased to see, Kubo and the Two Strings. That film brought in 12.6 million, so that's doing really well. The film is gorgeous. The film is absolutely beautiful. I can't say enough nice things about that film.
Did you see it?
Well, yes.
Okay.
I would hope she'd seen it if she's praising it like that.
Okay.
But yeah, I saw it too, Michelle. And yeah, this is another great film from Leica. I'd like to see how well it's doing at the box office compared to Leica's other releases. But this is really strong from them.
I see it as Focus Features' main Oscar push, you know, as far as animated features go.
Oh, definitely. It has to be one of the animated feature Oscar noms, definitely.
That and Sausage Party.
Yeah, and I know we're all big fans of that studio, you know, like films with Paranorman and their, you know, Coraline and their previous ventures. So, good news for that. However, as we said, the big flop of the summer has been Ben-Hur. Brought in the 100 million, and the film cost 100 million. Plus to make, and with marketing and everything, it brought in only $11.3 million. So it's going to have to do really well overseas, but Paramount Pictures is just going to take a bath on this one. They've had, you know, and their other films have been doing Fair to Midland this summer anyway, so they're kind of in that Warner Brothers swamp of films that are not performing as well as they would like. I mean, they had Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Zoolander 2, those have not done so well. So they were hoping that the Christian-based film-going audiences would turn out. I mean, Noah did respectably well, you know, with $47 million. But then again, they had Exodus, Gods, and Kings, and that film only made $24 million. So that's not good. And, you know, you can't remake a classic, a Charlton Heston classic. It just didn't work.
Well, they did that with Planet of the Apes, so that worked out, but that's a different genre.
Yeah, exactly.
When are they going to remake Soylent Green?
Oh, my gosh. I would be so in line for that. That is one of the best science fiction films. I love that film.
Okay, moving on.
And at number six, doing really well, is the Disney remake, Peach Dragon, that brought in $11.3 million. So that was kind of neck and neck with, we'll see when the final numbers come out. That film's doing really well still. That film total now stands at worldwide $57 million. So it's doing well. It's connecting with audiences. Somebody's going to see it.
Well, $57 million worldwide, that doesn't sound that great to me for a Disney release, though.
Exactly. Yeah. But who knows? It probably will do better, you know, once it gets to home video and Redbox and whatnot. At number seven is Bad Moms. Made $8.1 million. And right now, worldwide, the film stands at $106 million. I think it's really funny, too. Talk to anybody who's seen it, and they just...
Yeah, that's pretty strong, yeah. My mother and her girlfriend's wanting to see it once it gets closer to their hometown, and I prepared them. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. I have a feeling that STX Entertainment is going to try to make a... They might try to make, for the actresses, kind of an award season push, so I expect maybe we'll get DVD screeners of that film, just a punch. Could be wrong, but... So what's next here? At number eight is Universal Pictures. Jason Bourne, the next film in that franchise, brought in $8 million, so that's doing still really well. But right now, domestically, the film has made $140 million at the box office. Number nine is the hilarious The Secret Life of Pets, brought in $5.8 million. And at number 10 is Meryl Streep's Florence Foster Jenkins. That film brought in $4.3 million, and it's been receiving really great reviews. Kate Markey reviewed it for the site. She gave it 4.5 or 5 stars. Did you guys get to the screening to see it?
I saw it. Lynn saw most of it, I believe. Yes.
Lynn, what did you think?
I liked it a lot. I was really pleased to see Hugh Grant back, and I thought Simon Helberg was very special in that role. But she's so good in everything, and... It takes a lot of talent to sing that bad.
Yeah, I'm thinking that they're going to push Hugh Grant for supporting actor, I'm thinking.
Have you noticed as of late, the last couple of years, Meryl Streep has a summer fun release movie, and then she has her big Oscar movie towards the end of the year. It's kind of, the last couple of years, she's kind of fallen into that pattern of, a lighter film, summer, and then a, award season contender.
Yeah, good strategy,
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on.
Okay, and number 11 is Paramount Pictures' Star Trek Beyond brought in $4 million. The film has brought in $231 million to date at the worldwide box office.
They canceled the plans for another film? Because I've heard reports on the internet that this is probably the end of the franchise for them.
As we said, Paramount Pictures has sent us the press release announcing the fourth film in the franchise, but they have not sent anything since.
Okay.
So there were rumors that they were going to kill it, but that's their biggest franchise. So I don't know. There's a new BS is doing, as we talked about, the new series. Yeah, we'll see. Well, that remains to be seen. But I mean, it looks like it's doing pretty well at the box office worldwide and here in the U.S. But rounding out the 12 is the great film. And Tom, you reviewed this film, Hell or High Water from Lionsgate. Film brought in $2.6 million at the box office. So, and that's having right now worldwide, it's at $3.5 million, and that's getting kind of a slow rollout. You know, I think it'll more and more theaters throughout the U.S. will start showing it. But it's received great reviews. Cinema Score, it's doing really well. Rotten Tomatoes, so that's the 12 at the box office.
Okay, great.
Oh yeah.
And then what opens this weekend? The Mechanic. That's going to be number one.
Yeah, that'd be nice if they show it to us.
Then they're not showing it to us. That never bodes well. But
I liked that first Mechanic movie. That was awesome. Well, I mean, the first one, of course, was the Charles Bronson one, 1972.
Yeah.
But the first Jason Statham Mechanic was pretty darn good too.
Oh, but it's Jason Statham. I mean, there are those of us who will line up to see any movie
I will. I'm with you, baby.
Also showing the 26th is the Don't Breathe horror film.
Yeah, I saw that.
Resurrection. Hands of Stone with Robert De Niro and Our Little Sister from Sony Pictures Classics.
Okie doke. Well, groovy. Well, I hope you can call again next week. But this Hell and High Water takes place in Texas, and that's where you live.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm in Texas, and right now it's like there's a lot of water. It's raining. It's like torrential raining right now.
So it's Hell or High Water there in Texas. All right. Well, I hope you can call again next Monday.
Good to talk to everybody.
All right.
We'll talk to you later.
Adios.
Talk to you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Okay, that was Michelle McHugh with the top 12. Now it's time to do some reviews. We got a lot of movies to review. I saw Don't Breathe.
Yo, I got our ticket out of here. Rumor is this guy is sitting on at least 300K. Boom!
That's your guy.
Wait, is he blind?
We messed up to rob a blind guy, isn't it?
Just because he's blind don't mean he's insane, bro.
Don't Breathe. Yeah, it was actually a college screening, but they let me in anyway because I told them I wanted to review it for the podcast. Oh, but then they said I can't review it, so I actually am not going to review it. I did see it though, but they told me to.
Tomorrow night.
Yeah, you guys will see it tomorrow, so we're going to actually review that next Monday.
But we can talk about who the director is. It's from the fellow that did the remake of Evil Dead.
Yes,
right?
Fede Alvarez.
And it stars the young lady from the Jane Levy.
Yeah, Jane Levy. And it also stars Stephen Lang, who's
the
who's,
villain from Avatar.
That's right. He's terrific in this film. I could talk about it a little bit. I just can't really review it. It's about these three young punks who break into a blind man's home thinking he'll be an easy target because supposedly he's sitting on a bunch of cash, but not really. It doesn't work out that way. It's pretty good. It's really dark though. I hope you guys don't have. I mean, I saw it at the Esquire, which has really good projection, and there were some scenes I could not tell what the heck was going on.
Yeah,
so I feel sorry for you guys seeing it at Ronnie's.
Yeah, we're seeing Ronnie's
because Ronnie sometimes has some of the worst projection in town. But I don't know, maybe not. Next week, next Monday, Michael Hafner is going to be in here, so all three of us will have seen it. So we'll review it then.
Yeah.
Don't Breathe. You and Lynn are sitting here, and you guys both saw War Dogs.
Now to a question that still has no clear answer. How did two 20-something young men land a $300 million Pentagon contract?
I have a big idea.
They call guys like us war dogs. Bottom feeders who make money off of war without ever stepping foot on the battlefield.
Did you review War Dogs, Jim?
I reviewed that,
How many? You gave it like 3.5?
I think I gave it 3.5,
yeah. All right, so you guys, sounds like you liked War Dogs pretty much. Why don't you guys talk about War Dogs? Lynn, what'd you like about War Dogs?
It was far more entertaining than I thought. It was really sharply written and quite funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it zipped along. I thought that the casting of Bradley Cooper was going to be stunt casting, but actually he played a character that was in more than one scene.
I didn't know Bradley Cooper was in it.
Yeah.
Oh, they're showing him in the commercials now. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I thought it was just because he owes Todd Phillips for his career because of The Hangover.
And he's one of the producers of the film, too.
Right. And so I thought Miles Teller, who just gets better with every film, was very good. It's based on a true story.
He's never going to be better than Fantastic Four. Come on.
Well, he might get an Oscar nomination for Bleed for this, which is coming out later this year. But Jonah Hill is back to being the chubby, chunky, foul-mouthed, crude con artist guy.
Mm-hmm.
Based on true story. The only drawbacks to me, because I gave it 3 of 4 stars, were that Todd Phillips was really duplicating scenes of Martin Scorsese techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And the classic rock score got a little heavy-handed.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, what do you think?
Well,
3.5 out of 4.
Yeah, I say it's a pleasant surprise because we've just been pummeled over the heads with these constant trailers. It seems like every time that I'd see trailers before a movie, that would be one of them, and I was getting tired of it. And they were selling this movie as kind of a stupid let's party, let's shoot off guns, bromance type of thing. And it's not. It's got a good satiric thrust to it. It's really takes aim at previous political administrations. The main plot involves the fact that they opened up bidding for armaments, war weapons, and all that. They because of a certain no bid scandal, they had a website, or maybe they still have a website in which anybody can bid on supplying, you know, the different needs of different areas. The trailer makes you think it's all set in the Middle East, but a good chunk of it is set in Albania, and that's where the guys find warehouses of weapons that the government has to get rid of. It's really sharp. I'd say that that Jonah is and shows a darker side in this film. That was one of my main complaints about the movie, besides the one you mentioned, Lynn, or the two you mentioned, were the constant partying scenes. We always had to have scenes of the guys hitting a bong and, you know, doing a joint and lots of coke snorting, particularly on the Jonah Hill character's account.
Right.
But this might be the reason that it takes a darker turn towards the end of it, where he succumbs to greed and paranoia. He believes everybody's out to get him. He doesn't trust Miles Teller's character anymore. And it's a nice sort of rags to riches to rags story again about the downfall of these guys. And it's just petty greed that really ruins them. And there's also good supporting performances from Kevin Pollak.
That's right.
Who plays a fellow that has a chain of dry cleaning, yeah. Who is Jonah's sort of partner. And he's kind of taken a blind eye. Well, he's not told everything that's going on. And he's very good in it. I'd say this Ara de Armas, I believe it's her
Anna.
Name. Anna de Armas, who plays Miles' girlfriend, is very good. It's a role that you thought, well, they're throwing in a love story to keep our interest. And I compared it to the MGM Marx Brothers movies, in which you always had to have some young couple that they had to help. That, you know, thinking the audience wouldn't care what's going on unless there's a love interest. But she turns out to be a pivotal part of the plot. She's a reason for Miles getting into this business, and she's sort of his conscience at the by the end of the film.
And she's in the movie tonight, Hands of Stone.
She's in Hands of Stone also.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, she's an up-and-comer. So, yeah.
Sounds like you guys like War Dogs pretty much. You don't think it's the best movie in town, but it's worth checking out.
Yeah, it's better than the trailers. Don't believe them.
Very good. Okay, let's move on to another movie. I saw Bloodfather.
I got no idea how you piss guys like that off. What do they want from you?
They worked for my boyfriend. Please don't hurt her. I killed him.
Bloodfather. I had to drive all the way out to the Arnold 14 to see this movie, Bloodfather. And I got there.
Hope you brought lots of water and all that for
provisions.
A long trip.
While you guys were seeing Kubo and the Two Strings Monday night, I went out and saw Bloodfather. And I was the only person in the audience. But much to my surprise, the Arnold 14 has carried it over a second week, so it is still showing over at the Arnold 14. Bloodfather...
Is it more than one showing a day, I wonder?
I'm not sure. It was last week. Bloodfather stars Erin Moriarty. Do we know who she is?
Well, yeah, she was just in that Captain Fantastic movie.
Okay.
She was the young gal that comes on to him.
Well, she plays a young woman who's living in California, and she's mixed up with her boyfriend, who's a Mexican drug dealer, and he's all messed up in the Mexican cartel, and he wants her to perform a hit, and she refuses, ends up shooting him in the neck, and so the whole cartel is coming after her to kill her, so she goes and hides out with her father, who is played by Mel Gibson. He plays, what was his name? John...
He plays Liam Neeson.
It is sort of similar to those films. But he's living in a trailer, and he's a tattoo artist and an ex-con, so she goes to live with him, and then these Mexican drug dealers come in, and he lives next door to William H. Macy, who is his AA sponsor, and then down the road is his best friend, his old army buddy, played by Michael Parks, who sells Nazi memorabilia online. So it's a colorful cast of characters in this Bloodfather. It's basically a kind of a long chase scene. There's not a whole lot to it, but it's really good. I got to give him credit. Mel Gibson's fantastic. He plays the kind of role that he used to play in movies like Payback or even Lethal Weapon, kind of a crazy guy. I really like seeing Mel. I haven't seen Mel in this type of role in a long time. It's the kind of role he used to specialize in before he fell out of favor in Hollywood.
Self-destructive.
Yeah, but it's good to see him back. This movie is directed by Jean-Francois Richer, who directed Messerine a couple years ago, which I reviewed at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. That was one of the Vincent Cassel's, a two-parter about a famous drug dealer over in France.
Did he direct the remake of Assault on Precinct 13 also?
Yes, he did.
Oh,
exactly,
okay.
Yeah. So Bloodfather, you know, it moves really quickly. It's violent as heck. It doesn't break any new ground. But if you want to see a good, bloody action film and you're a fan of Mel Gibson like I am, you could do a lot worse than The Bloodfather. But you might have to drive all the way out to Arnold to see it.
Unless you want to wait for the red box and a couple weeks.
Oh, actually, I got a notice from the studio. I think it comes out on Blu-ray in like 5 or 6 weeks. So, Bloodfather. I would have given it probably 4 out of 5 if I had reviewed it. All right, let's move along. While I was seeing Bloodfather, Jim and Lynn were seeing Kubo and the Two Strings.
It's time to follow my own path. My name is Kubo. This is my story.
Oh, you did not see that, though, did you?
I have not seen
that. You were there?
I was there.
Thinking you missed one of them last week.
Yeah,
who
no,
reviewed
I missed
that at
the Light of the Ocean.
Did you review that?
Yeah. Melissa did for our side.
Right.
Yes,
she said, that's right, she complained about the whiteness of it.
Oh,
yeah. She devoted the last paragraph to that, and that's like a minor thing, you know?
Well,
it's like complaining about Mulan, about Eddie Murphy playing the dragon, you know? Like,
well, there's a local connection to Kubo. Yeah. Brad Schiff.
Yeah, I interviewed him.
He is the head of animation for Laika.
Yeah, and you know, his father was Steve Schiff.
Yes.
Who was on channel, I forget what channel.
He was on Channel 4 from 1975 to 1985.
Yeah.
And KPLR 90 to 92.
Yes.
Oh, really?
So, yes. So, Brad Schiff.
He was kind of a Rod and Burgundy-esque sort of handsome newscaster guy.
Well, Brad Schiff went to Parkway West. And he was the lead animator on Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, a fine film.
Yes, and Coraline. It made the lot of lists on your 21.
Mm-hmm.
And then Corpse Bride, and then he won an Emmy for a show called Gary and Mike. But he also was the lead animator on Celebrity Deathmatch, if you remember
MTV,
that MTV series. Yeah. So now he's doing animation. Yes, and it's a beautiful film. It's beautiful. The story isn't as good as the animation, but I think it advances the studio in terms of the quality of animation. It's just
it is
gorgeous.
If you can see
but it's stop motion, right?
Yeah, it's stop motion. If you could see it in 3D, I'd say it's almost worth it for that. There you do some nice 3D effects. And what I love about the Laika films, if you stick around for the end credits, they'll give you a little peek behind the curtain. They show you how one of the sequences is animated during the end credits. It's very entertaining to me. My only problem, I don't think it's as strong as Paranorman. It's better than Box Trolls, but I think the Laika folks really need to concentrate on the story construction. It seems to drag a bit in the last act or so. That's my main complaint. The action kind of comes to a standstill. Still, the final showdown between Kubo and the Moon King. The voice work is strong.
You mean the white voice work?
Yeah, no. Just gonna say, there's plenty of George Takei is one of the voices of the villagers.
What's Melissa complaining about?
That? I don't know, but Brenda Vaccaro is one of the voices too. So that's
does she have a big part, Brenda Vaccaro?
Well, you're bigger than I thought. Yeah, and she's this kindly old woman who's a vendor. Kubo sort of makes a living by going into the village during the day and sort of putting on a storytelling show for tips and the little money thrown at
it's
him.
It's about time Brenda Vaccaro got a good role, darn it.
Oh, yeah.
He plays a Samson, which is a three-string lute-like instrument.
You mean two-string?
Well, it's three strings, but he only plays the two. But it's set in feudal Japan. This is Matthew McConaughey's first animated film.
Yeah. He illustrates a story by doing these elaborate origami figures that come to life, and
gorgeous.
It's delightful. He's got this magical colored paper that all of a sudden can turn itself into a dragon, or his father, the warrior Hasu. He's taking care of his mother, but his mother says, you have to get back to here before darkness falls, otherwise my evil sisters and your evil grandfather will come after you, and of course, you know that he's not going to make it back on one of those nights. And there's a marvelous scene with the village being attacked by the ghostly sisters who are voiced by Rooney Mara. And it's incredible. It's like something out of like a Godzilla movie or something with these people scrambling, all done in this wonderful 2D, stop motion animation.
We did see it in 3D,
but this is unlike the CGI. These are all figures moved by hand. And it's just a remarkable achievement. And as we said, it is a gorgeous film. McConaughey is great as this samurai who, until I saw the film, I didn't realize that he's a beetle. He's got four arms, so he's almost a throwback.
Who's the voice of Kubo?
Kubo is Art Parkinson.
He's a new one, but he was terrific.
Yeah, and the monkey that befriends him, more like a baboon, is voiced wonderfully by Charlize Theron, who was channeling a little Furiosa in there in certain scenes. So, yeah, this is a terrific film. There's a wonderful battle with a giant skeleton that has all these swords stuck in his head. They're on a quest to get these fantastical weapons. One of them is an indestructible sword, which is sticking in the skull of this giant creature. Amazing scene. Yeah, and they also need to get this shield and a vest. And it's so it's got sort of a, you know, a journey type film.
But, it's a little scary for the wee ones, I would say.
Hmm. Did you review it for the Belleville
I did.
Democrat?
I did.
How many stars did you give it, Lynn?
3.5 out of 4.
3.5 out of 4.
I'd give it 4. Solid, for sure.
And how many did Melissa give it? She gave it 4, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It has to be one of the big contenders for Best Animated Feature come Oscar time, I would think.
All right, so Jim and Lynn both recommend Kubo and the Two Strings. Another movie that opens this Friday is called Our Little Sister. Yeah. What do we know about this movie, Our Little Sister? Have you both seen it?
Did you see it? I didn't see it, but Jim did see Our Little Sister. Tell me about this movie, Jim.
Oh, it's a charming, sweet little film. It's,
no, really.
It's based on a manga. It's actually based on a Japanese graphic novel, and it's produced by the Toho Company, the people that brought us Godzilla and Mothra and all those great
creatures. Does Godzilla make a cameo?
No, Mothra.
I'm seeing Mothra on the big screen tomorrow night, by the way.
With the riff tracks or something?
Yeah, and I'm so excited. I love Mothra. I don't care about the riff tracks. I'm just so excited to see Mothra on the big screen. That's going to be amazing.
Well, speaking of the twins from that, this is pretty much a film about women. It's sort of a cross between the classic story Little Women and a film that a lot of listeners might fondly remember from TV of the early 70s. That was the premiere show on the CBS Children's Film Festival that was hosted by Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
Yeah, that was on Saturday morning.
Yeah, it was. And their initial offering was this little sweet film called Skinny and Fatty.
I remember that one. Oh. See, that's like the only one I remember.
Yeah,
and that was Japanese, though.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, that's just Japanese also.
Oh, okay. So, yeah,
it's a sweet little film. It's about three women in their 20s, and they're sharing their grandmother's house. Their mother has gotten out of their lives after, you know, her husband, you know, left them pretty much. So she left the kids pretty much to stay in this house. And the women are all different. The eldest sort of runs things, and she's the more responsible one, works in a hospital. The one that's younger is always hooking up with these guys that are hitting her up for money. And the one that's the youngest, the littlest sister, she's working at a sports supply place, and she's got a wacky relationship with this guy who is a mountain climber, and he brags about having lost 3 toes. But they find out that their father has passed away. He was living with his third wife at the spa, so they travel to the spa, and you think it's a sweet little film, but it's as soon as they get there to their room there at the spa, the middle sister says, "I need a beer." And I was like, "Oh, okay. These girls aren't, you know, the sweet innocent things that you would think." And they discover that they actually have a stepsister, a little sister who's about 13 or 14 years old. She's living with her stepmother. It seems that this is the daughter that their father had from his second marriage, and his wife from the second marriage had already passed on.
Okay, cut to the chase. What's so good about this
movie?
It's
sweet, and it's charming, and it's very funny, and it's evolving, and you find out how these girls all live together, and it's really really entertaining.
So it's in Japanese with English subtitles?
With English subtitles, very easy to follow subtitles. Okay. It's about love and death and them trying to reconnect with their mother, and I would recommend it. I'm probably going to give it 4 out of 5
All
stars.
Right.
I think it's a great film for tweens, I guess, that would be the target audience.
All right. So
entertaining.
Look for Jim's review of Our Little Sister Thursday night at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Kate Marquis reviewed Ben-Hur, and she gave it, 2 out of 5? Oh, my
Something
gosh.
Like
how long were you a slave?
5 years.
What is your name?
Ben-Hur. My family was one of the most respected in Jerusalem. Welcome home.
Please, I need you to tell me who one's enemies are.
Masala, I won't name names. Until we were betrayed.
And it didn't do very well at the box office, but I saw it Friday night, and I thought it was pretty good. It stars Jack Huston as Ben-Hur, the role played by Charlton Heston back in 1959, and Toby Kebbell as, what was his name, Marcellus?
Yes, the Stephen Boyd role.
That's right, the Stephen Boyd role, and they're actually stepbrothers in this one. I think they were just friends in 1959.
They were.
Ben-Hur is this a Jewish man of privilege until he's sort of betrayed by his best friend and sent to be a galley slave. It starts out pretty awkward. I thought I wasn't going to like this movie. It had that sort of stilted dialogue that you sometimes see in these faith-based films. And neither of these actors, I didn't think, brought much gravitas to their characters. They both seem like pretty boys. But then a funny thing happens. Jack Houston is Ben-Hur, becomes a slave. He becomes a galley slave, and he's stuck in the bowels of this this warship. And then there's this battle scene that's shown from his point of view, and he can only see through the tiny hole in the ship where his oar is out of the ship. So they show this battle scene through this obstructed view, and it's really spectacular. And at that point that the movie sort of shifts gears and becomes really, really good. He is lost at sea. He's the only one to survive this battle. He's lost at sea. He's washed up and found by Morgan Freeman as this guy who trains horses for the Romans to use in their chariot races. That role was played by Hugh Griffin in 1959, and he won the Oscar for playing that role. And so he trains with Morgan Freeman for a while and becomes a really good chariot racer. So they head back to Rome, and he gets revenge on Marcellus by challenging him to this chariot race. And that's the big spectacular climax of Ben-Hur, as it was in 1959. And the chariot race is great. I read a couple of reviews that say, oh, the chariot race is all CGI. Well, I don't know what movie these people saw, and maybe it looked cheesier in 3D or something, but the chariot race I saw did not look CGI at all. I'm sure it was CGI enhanced, but what I saw was a lot of horses and a lot of great stunt work, and it was thrilling. In fact, if anything, I think it was probably inspired by Mad Max, the way the chariot race was shot. It is spectacular. It's the best pure action scene I have seen since Mad Max. Like I say, I wish the casting would have been a little different. I think it might have done a little better over the weekend if it had somebody box office in the lead role.
It cost $100 million to make.
It's all up there on the screen, though.
Yeah, I'm surprised it cost that little. I mean, to recreate those ancient times, it must have cost a lot of money, even in CGI.
Yeah, and like I say, the CGI is... I'm sure there is some CGI in the horse race, but it's not like this director did... His name is Timur Bekmambetov. Yeah. And I saw a movie he did a couple years ago called Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which was kind of a fun film. But that had cheesy CGI. I know cheesy CGI. And this chariot race scene and this spectacular battle at sea sequences, those are not cheesy CGI. Those are really good special effects and action scenes and stunt work. So I don't know where people are coming from with this stuff. Like I say, it's really good. If about 2 hours and 10 minutes long, which is about an hour and 40 minutes shorter than the 1959 version. It's made for a modern audience, and a modern audience, frankly, doesn't have the patience to sit through a four-hour movie. If they had released a four-hour movie of Ben-Hur today, nobody would go see it.
As no one's going to see this one, it sounds like,
true, but if they released the one with Charlton Heston today, nobody would go see it.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, they're going to have it at the Classics.
I know, and we're going to talk about that here in a minute. So I would have given Ben-Hur, 3.5 or maybe even 4 out of 5 stars. It's well worth seeing. It's a lot better than most other movies in town, and it's too bad that it's not finding an audience. All right, let's move on. Jim, you wanted to talk about something called Floyd Norman?
Oh,
is that
open
Friday?
Well, that's available on, I think, video on demand.
All right, we'll make
streaming.
It quick. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Is this the anime, the one about the animator or something?
Yeah, this is about an animator from Disney.
And what's the name of the film?
Floyd Norman, An Animated Life. Terrific doc. Floyd Norman is a wonderful animator from Disney. Started working with them on Sleeping Beauty. Was with Disney on and off through the 50s and 60s into the 70s. And the main thrust of the film is the fact that he was mandatorily retired at age 65. And his wife, his second wife in the film, that she's still working for Disney and Disney Publishing, and he would drive her to work. And what he would do, instead of just dropping her off, he'd go in and take over an empty cubicle or an empty office. And he called it floitering. Mm-hmm. And he would be there, and he'd work on things and, talk to folks there and do commission drawings. And finally, I think Pixar heard about him being at Liberty, I guess would be the term, and brought him in to work on Monsters, Inc. And it's about him fighting this idea that you're... productivity stops at age 65.
So this is pretty good.
Oh, it's a terrific film.
It opens this weekend.
Yeah, it's as good as the other great Disney documentaries like Walt and El Grupo and Waking Sleeping Beauty and this recent one, Life Animated.
All right, so look for Jim's review of Floyd Norman, An Animated Life, and that'll be up Thursday night at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Tonight, what are we seeing tonight?
Oh, we're seeing the Hands of Stone.
I've trained more world champs than anyone else in boxing history. I haven't stepped into a ring for more than a decade. In 66 seconds, Roberto Duran changed my life.
The Roberto Duran story, and his trainer was a guy in his 70s named Ray Arcel, and he was played by Robert De Niro. Edgar Ramirez, who wasn't he the husband in Joy?
In Joy, yeah.
Yeah, okay. He plays Roberto Duran, and I assume they beefed him up for this.
And he was in the remake of Point Break as the Patrick Swayze character.
All right. And then also today we're seeing The Ninth Life of Louis Drax. That is from director Alexandra Haja, who did the remake of The Hills Have Eyes, which I thought was pretty good. He's actually known for his horror films. He
Piranha
did Mirrors.
3D.
That's right, Piranha 3D, and High Tension, which is a movie he directed in his native France. So we'll be back and review those next week. Also, The Mechanic.
The principal I represent has an offer for you. Each death must look like an accident. Your specialty, I believe.
Not doing his kills.
Which they're not going to show to us, but I'm sure I'll see it this weekend because I love the first Mechanic. All right, lots of local stuff to talk about. Midnight at the Tivoli this weekend. Event Horizon. You ever seen that, Lynn?
Yes.
That was directed by Paul Anderson, but not the Paul Anderson who did Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood.
PTA. That's PTA.
Yeah, that's PTA. This is Paul W.S. Anderson, as he goes by now, and he's more known for directing movies like Alien vs. Predator and Mortal Kombat. And
did the Resident Evil film?
He did the Resident Evil. He's not a bad director, but he is a bit of a hack, I guess. But this is his best film. I saw this movie 20 years ago, and it takes place in outer space. It stars Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Neill, and it's really gory. And I've had a lot of young movie buffs want to talk to me about this movie over the years, so I'm not surprised that it's kind of achieved this sort of cult status that is now a midnight movie that is playing at the Tivoli. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of crowd we get. That's midnight this weekend, and I will have a bunch of swag to hand out Friday night. Next Thursday night, over at Schlafly Bottle Works, is Four Color Eulogy. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes.
You saw that?
Yeah, that's Jason Contini and a cast of many local people.
That's right.
Wyatt Weed and Gail.
Yeah, Wyatt directed it, and it was written by Jason Contini, and it co-stars his father, John.
A lot of South City shows.
Yeah, a lot of good St. Louis color. Jim and I think had some problems with the script. It didn't move very quickly. I think we would have both liked to see some more of the comic book stuff that they referred to. When I saw it, I saw it before I interviewed Wyatt, and I saw a 2-hour and 15-minute director's cut. I think they whittled it down to about 2 hours, so this will be the first time I've seen it 2 hours, so maybe it moves a little quicker.
I thought the acting was quite strong because it was a lot of people in the theater community.
Yep, those theater actors. Yeah. This is next Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
They know how to talk good.
That to be September 1st, and it is $6 to get in, but all that money goes to a worthy charity called Helping Kids Together.
Yes.
This is part of the A film series, as they call it.
Yeah, but different from a lot of their other films. You know, yeah. It's not a horror film or a genre film or something.
Yeah, well, last month we did Reefer Madness. I think she's trying to find movies in the public domain because she was tired of paying, you know, $200 licensing fees and having, you know, 10 people show up. And
yeah, we saw Last Man on
Earth? Last Man on Earth was the month before that, and there was a lot of people that turned up for that.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised.
But, I saw Reefer Madness at a college screening, and they mixed up the reels.
And nobody noticed yet. Were you high on drugs?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. All right, so that's that. This Thursday night over at the Way Out Club is the Lilliputian Film Festival. Anybody heard of this?
I'd never heard of it until I saw your article, Tom.
I never heard of it until the guy who's putting it on contacted me and asked me to help promote it. It's a series of short films, hence the title Lilliputian, I guess. Hmm. I don't know. Dane Marty, who has sat in the coveted Michelle chair before, has a short film in this. I don't know too much about it. I know it starts at 8 o'clock, and it's at the Way Out Club, which is at 2525 Jefferson, and it is free. So it's a bunch of short films, and I'm not sure if they're local filmmakers or not. I think some of them are made by local filmmakers.
Well, is it the Lilliputians? Aren't they in Gulliver's Travels?
Yeah.
That's right. They're the little people, yes.
The little people, okay.
Yeah. I kind of like the Jack Black Gulliver's Travels.
I like the Fleischer Brothers animated one. It's a hep, hep, happy day.
Okay. And then, also locally, Raiders of the Lost Ark fan film. The story of the greatest fan film ever made is a documentary about this Raiders of the Lost Ark adaption that was made by a bunch of teenagers couple decades ago. And Jim, you say you've seen the adaption, right?
Yeah, several years ago at Webster, they showed the adaption. I think one or two of the filmmakers were there. And these were a couple of kids, I guess high school age or so. growing up in South Carolina or somewhere around there. And they were so enamored of Raiders of the Lost Ark, they decided they were going to remake it.
Actually, it took them 7 years. When they were 11 years old, 11. And I guess they finished when they were 18.
Yes, shot for shot, as best they could. There were certain sequences they couldn't recreate, but they decided that they were going to recreate the whole thing on their home video cameras.
Mm-hmm. With the boulder running?
They showed that they have a big papier-mâché boulder that they made. Yeah, the scene in the bar room, the big shootout, had to, sort of without telling anyone, they did the fire effects themselves. Yeah. And I'm sure they violated several fire marshal codes and things like that. Yeah. But it's awfully sweet. I don't think they could do the thing with the airplane, you know, that with Indy and Marion running from the plane.
But they did
later on.
They did over two decades later that they reunited with the original cast members to complete their masterpiece and recreate the scene with the exploding airplane. And then so this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Webster University's Moore Auditorium, they are showing a documentary about these guys making this film, and they are showing the film. The film lasts 100 minutes. I think the documentary lasts about that long as well. So that should be really interesting.
Yeah, that was when I was up in Chicago, that was playing at the Music Box. And I almost went to see that, but instead I saw De Palma. So I'll see this one at Webster, that's for certain.
Yeah, me too.
Support Webster.
That's right, doggone it. Okay, I love seeing old movies on the big screen. Last night I saw Thelma and Louise. I hadn't seen that since it was new. I don't think it's aged all that well. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes. It just kind of meanders, but it's okay.
Well, they had it the wrong ratio, you said?
Oh, yeah.
They had it at the TV ratio or something?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous, man.
Yeah, it made Gina Davis look even skinnier than she really is.
And Brad Pitt look even hunkier?
Yeah. Brad Pitt. Next one for that's the Fathom Events series, is Dr. Strangelove, and that's September, I think, 18th and 22nd
Slim
or something.
Pickens.
That's right. And they got The King and I coming up, and From Here to Eternity, and The Shining, and a couple of others. So they don't get very big crowds. There's a market for people to get out of the house and go see old movies on the big screen, as the High Point proves every month when they get 200 or more to show up for their classic film festival. But I don't know why the Fathom Events people can't get. Well, for one thing, they're charging
regular prices, right?
Well, yeah. No, it's actually more.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know. They give me 2 free passes every time, and I take my mother-in-law, but a friend of ours joined us, and her ticket was like almost $14.
Oh, good heavens. Yeah. You can buy it, gosh sakes.
I know, and it didn't look that good. I would have demanded my money back the way they had the...
Did they have any, like, a special intro to it or something?
Yeah, they did, but it was boring.
Oh.
Just some guy standing there talking about it. It looked like he was reading something he had written.
It wasn't Ridley Scott talking about it.
Nothing like that.
Well, that's a bummer.
All right, but what's really cool is... this new film series down at the Tivoli, starting September 7th, they're calling it the Classics in the Loop film series. This is amazing.
It's going to be Wednesday nights?
Wednesday nights. Every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock for $7, you can go see a classic movie and movies that are crying out to be seen on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
This is so cool. I had no idea they were doing this film series until I got an email about it last week. And starting September 7th, Ben-Hur. We were just talking about Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
But if you can't get enough of Ben-Hur after seeing the 2-hour and 10-minute version, you can go see the 3-hour and 50-minute version on September 7th,
yes.
Which I've never seen on the big screen. Have you seen that on the big screen?
No, I haven't. I saw it on the little screen.
Just on the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of exciting. And then September 14th, The Sound of Music. You ever seen that one on the big screen?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
I'd never seen The Sound of Music in my life until last year.
Oh, my
They
goodness.
Had a 50th anniversary thing.
They have sing-alongs to it.
You betcha.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
I think they'll sing along even if it's not a sing-along, just to annoy the other people in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. They had a reunited show with the original cast.
Oh, yeah?
When Oprah was still around. Julie.
Well, Oprah Andrews. Was not in the original.
No, but they were
all
her.
She hosted
her. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Right. And Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer were there with all the kids.
Well, good. Okay, the weekend after that is September 28th. That's La Dolce Vita, which they just showed at the W about a year ago. I saw it there. But nobody here is going to that because that is the night that I am doing the King Bagot tribute over at the St. Louis History Museum. So don't go see La Dolce Vita on the 28th. Just go rent it on Blu-ray and go see me at this History Museum for free. All right, October 5th, The Ten Commandments, another movie I grew up with but I've never seen on the big screen.
With Big Chuck Heston?
With Big Chuck Heston and Vincent Price and all kinds
Edward
of good
G.
actors.
Robin?
Yeah, yeah.
Where's your Messiah now?
There you go. So, but these are all great movies. These are all big, you know, widescreen movies, long movies that deserve to be seen on the big screen. October 12th, Gone with the Wind, which is not a widescreen movie, but...
CinemaScope, right? Those classic 50s movies.
Gone with the Wind, I haven't seen that on the big screen in 40 years.
When I was 13, my mother took me to the Ambassador Theater to sit in the mezzanine seat. That's when you had different tickets for different floors, you know, your prices.
Oh, yeah.
And that was when they only reissued it every 7 years because I had read the book that summer.
Yeah.
It's still wonderfully made film for 1939.
Oh, definitely. And then October 19th is The Seven Samurai, which should coincide with the remake of The Magnificent Seven, more or less.
Yeah.
Do you think they're going to have the score for Magnificent Seven?
Oh, they would have. They'd have to.
They would have to work in the theme, or they
maybe
or
over the
losers. I'm not excited about that. And then October 26th is Dr. Zhivago, which will be a fun movie to see on the big screen as well.
So gorgeous!
It is. It is. So that's really exciting. The classic and the Loop film series. I'll be putting up articles every week about these.
And hopefully, these will be in the main auditorium.
They better be.
Yeah. They from time to time they've had done that because I've seen Gone with the Wind at the Tivoli.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, back in the day, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Speaking of old movies, last month I went to the Webster University and I saw Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh, excellent.
Which got me to thinking how much I like Sandy Dennis. And then I went home that night and I watched The Out-of-Towners because I had that on DVD and I really love that movie, The Out-of-Towners. And it was directed by Arthur Hiller.
Yes, R.I.P.
Yeah, who just and I think we all had the same response when we heard that Arthur Hiller had died. Wow, Arthur Hiller was still alive.
He'd made a movie 10 years ago. I saw. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was known for a lot of genial type comedies, but then he did some real edgy, darker stuff like The Hospital and Teachers.
Well, and The Americanization of Emily.
Well, he's not a director I've given much thought to, but then when I looked at his list of movies, I saw tons of his movies, and there were some really funny movies on this list.
Funny and serious.
Oh,
yeah. He was all over the place.
Right.
He didn't specialize in one genre.
Yeah.
He started out in television where he did everything from The Addams Family to Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And Zane Grey Theater,
and Wonderful World of Color on Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, he had an Oscar nomination for Love Story, and then he did Silver Streak and another comedy with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor,
and The In-Laws,
and The Lonely Guy with Steve Martin. I love that movie.
Yeah. It's terrific films on his resume.
Mm-hmm. Outrageous Fortune, one of Bette Midler's early movies with Shelley Long, very funny.
I noticed on there Nightwing. Is that the one about the bats attacking people?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he did a horror film,
too. Lou Diamond Phillips, I think, was in there.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, The Hospital with George C. Scott was pretty groundbreaking back then because it was a real dark view of...
Actually, Lou Diamond Phillips was in Bats. Nightwing had Armando Santi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I just corrected myself. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt.
But Hospital is really, guys, it was kind of Patty Chayefsky's follow-up to Network.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
of course, Patty, I guess, wrote also.
No, The Hospital was before Network.
71.
Okay, Network, yeah.
Yeah. And then he did W.C. Fields and Me with Rod Steiger and Valerie Perrine.
I never saw that. That was considered pretty bad.
And John Goodman's when
the
he
babe,
played
yeah.
The Babe.
Yeah, Babe. Yeah, Babe Ruth.
So
yeah.
It was quite interesting. That you said it was all over the place, his career.
Oh, yeah. But his probably best-known movie is probably Love Story.
Probably, but I've never seen Love Story.
Oh, my God. It has not aged well, let me tell you. But Ally McGraw was the girl when I was in high school. And, of course, how many kids are named Ryan for Ryan O'Neill? And then also Tommy Lee Jones is in it as Ryan O'Neill's roommate at Harvard.
That's right.
Well, didn't Al Gore say it was based on he and Tipper's story?
Yeah.
Well, she didn't die at age 25 and of cancer.
This was right before he invented the internet. Let's move on then. So RIP to Arthur Hiller. I think he was, 92 or something?
92.
He was up there,
We also lost Jack Riley, I should mention, really quickly.
Right,
probably best known for television, but he was in Boogie Nights. He was the voice of the dad on the Rugrats.
He was
the
in Catch 22 with Bob Newhart.
That's right. But he'll always be Bob Newhart's favorite patient on his old sitcom, Mr. Carlin.
The
crotchety, cranky Mr. Carlin.
So, RIP. How old was that guy?
He was 80.
80, huh? Well, Oh, well. R.I.P. to him. R.I.P. to Arthur Hiller. We want to talk a little bit about some remakes that are coming up. We only have a couple of minutes.
Well, the new news is A Star is Born is going to pair Bradley Cooper with Lady Gaga. And this is the fourth time it will be remade. But Bradley Cooper is going to make his directorial debut.
Wow, this has hit written all over it.
Well, the Eastwood was supposedly going to do this 4 or 5 years ago with Beyonce. So this is a project that's been kicking around forever. We'll see if it, if it hits before the cameras or not.
Speaking of Eastwood, one of my favorite Eastwood movies is The Beguiled from 1971, which was directed by Don Siegel the same year that they teamed up for Dirty Harry. And that is being remade. In fact, I think they've already wrapped that. That stars Colin Farrell as McBaney, the character that Clint Eastwood played in 1971. And Nicole Kidman is playing the Geraldine Page character. That is, have you ever seen that, The Beguiled?
Yes.
It's a really interesting movie about...
Who's the actress that's in it? Bonnie Bedelia?
No, is it's that? Elizabeth Hartman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Elizabeth Hartman. Okay.
Yeah. And then that young Pam Ferdin...
Pamela Ferdin, she was in it. But who's is this Sofia Coppola directing?
Sofia Coppola is directing this new Beguiled, so I'm looking forward to this. And also, there's a remake of Death Wish supposedly in the works. I'll believe it when I all these remakes. I'll believe them when
I
see
them. Well, they've been kicking around Death Wish for
a while.
Yeah,
but supposedly
too,
they're really talking seriously about this one. Eli Roth is directing it, who's kind of a hit and miss director, but mostly a hit director in my book.
But a lot of and Bruce Hostel and.
Yeah, Bruce Willis will be playing the Charles Bronson role. A lot of Bronson movies have been remade. The Mechanic was a remake of a Bronson movie. The Magnificent Seven is a remake of a Bronson movie.
Have they done Dirty Dozen yet?
Not yet. They should do Hard Times. That would be a good one.
Yeah, I guess Suicide Squad's kind of a superhero version of the Dirty Dozen.
There you go.
Oh, yes.
And they're also
right.
remaking The Crow, which is only 20 years ago that they made The Crow.
They've talked about that quite a bit, I think. Yeah. But that's kind of cursed.
Yeah, oh yeah. I hope they get a different weapons handler on the crew for this one.
So
if I was Jason Momoa, I'd be wearing like a bulletproof vest the entire time. Because he is playing
The
Crow
in this new one. I think that would be bad karma, actually. I think they should stay away from that. Yeah. But Beaches is being remade, but it's going to be on Lifetime.
No, well, you know what's good if it's going to be on Lifetime.
And Idina Menzel, our
Adele Dazeem.
Yes. She's playing the Bette Midler role.
All right. Well, movies to look forward to or to not look forward to. Well, we got to wrap it up, doggone it. Seems like we just got started. And before you know it, comes the time we have to say goodbye. So be sure to check us out next week. We'll review the new Mechanic movie and Hands of Stone and the Nine Lives of Louis Drax. And what's the one you're seeing at 11?
Equality.
Equality.
Equity.
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 Yes.
Well, actually, some of them don't start till September 2nd.
All right. Well, we'll be back to review a bunch of other movies next week, because we always do. But for now, we got to sign off. My name's Tom Stockrun.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
And be sure to listen again next week.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather.
Oh,
naughty,
Dave.
Hello, Dolly.
Hey.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, smash. Black leather, crash. Black leather, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock.
Forward into battle, there, chaps.
Crash, crash, crash. Black leather, smash.
You're happy in your work, Joni.